Well, hello there. Welcome to yet another exciting edition of Cooper Talks. And I use the word exciting quite wrongly, but thank you very much for joining in, and I hope this proves useful to you. Today, I'm going to be looking at part two of the League of Nations, looking at the 1930s and how ultimately the League of Nations led to a failure. So if you haven't listened to the previous podcast on the League of Nations in the 1920s, be warned, spoilers lie ahead. So where do we begin? Well, just to recap then, the 1920s, the League had some successes, but the problems were apparent. Okay, there were a lot of issues there that showed that the League was not in a secure or strong position. Now, the thing that's going to turn this all around and basically expose these flaws to the world is the Wall Street crash in October 1929. That, in turn, triggers something called the Great Depression in America. Now, I'll probably do something about the Great Depression on its own because I think it's worth knowing about. But for the time being, what that means is basically American businesses started to collapse. There was widespread poverty that led to rapid unemployment. Now, it was kind of inevitable if you look at the American economy in the 1920s that this was always likely to happen. There would be some form of depression, just as when you look back, it's quite often inevitable that there will be recessions. But the Wall Street crash is what triggered the Great Depression. And what that meant was a mass collapse in American businesses and trade, which had a knock-on impact to everywhere else in the world. So, you know, American businesses were buying copper from Chile. They were buying raw materials from sub-Saharan Africa or Asia and importing them. And because the American economy collapsed, so did all those subsidiary goods. It also leads to a massive problem with protectionism. In order to try and protect their economies, various countries started, including led by America, started increasing tariffs, which actually generally have the opposite effect. They actually, in protecting your own trade, they tend to lead to an inability to trade with other nations. Everyone puts up the tariffs and it slows the economy down. And countries start panicking, they start worrying, they start getting poorer. This obviously affected somewhere like Germany far more than other countries because the Dawes Plan, which had been used to provide funds for Germany with which to pay off the reparations and get its economy going, that was stopped. And then the Americans asked for their money back at the same time. So Germany's hit twice. Now, what impact does this have on the League of Nations? Well, first of all, it makes countries very, very reluctant to impose economic sanctions. Now, not that these had been brilliantly successful in the 1920s, but they had at least provided a threat. But because countries like America, Britain, France are going to be hesitant to impose economic sanctions on a major player like Japan or Italy, it undermines the threat that the League of Nations carries, as major players know that the League isn't likely to impose sanctions particularly quickly. And particularly with America not being in the League, it's always likely that America will continue trading and ignore economic sanctions. So that's going to be one massive problem resulting from this for the League of Nations. Its sanctions were weak, but they become weaker. The other problem is military endeavours and campaigns were obviously very, very expensive in the first place. Now, countries like Britain and France weren't that keen to get involved in military campaigns, international affairs, but they're going to become far less keen to get involved unless their interests are directly affected. And what this means is the League's lack of a military becomes more of a problem in the 1930s. Those member states that have military capabilities are going to be more reluctant to use it in the event of a serious breach of League protocol or League enforcement. And that means countries with a strong military know they're very unlikely to face any major military opposition as countries like Britain and France try and find an alternative to military action. So the moral sanctions are still there, but the economic sanctions have been reduced and any military threat evaporates. Now, that's why the League became less able to deal with problems that they arose. But on the flip side, the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression led to two other problems that grew. One of those was national self-interest. As countries start turning inwards and looking on how best to protect and enhance their own economies. And this leads to countries who have who don't have empires, looking to create empires in order to facilitate trade. Countries like Britain and France, and to a degree America, were seen to be shielded from the worst effects of the economic depression because they were able to use the raw materials from their empires and to then trade with their empires. And I know you'll be saying, America didn't have an empire. Maybe not in name, but obviously it's various territories, places like Puerto Rico, Guam, Guatemala, the Philippines at the time, did protect it a little bit from the worst excesses compared to countries like Italy and Japan. So countries who are powerful but don't have a large empire are going to seek to create an empire and expand where they can. And that's going to lead to both Japan and Italy launching conquests in order to enhance their own economic situation. And the final aspect of this is that the collapse of international trade tends to lead people to turn towards nationalism, strong national pride. Now, this obviously happens in Germany and sees a ride in the National Socialist Party, the Nazi Party, gaining power. But it sees countries all over the world turning towards a more extreme form of nationalism, the national self-interest, trying to seek pride in their nations at the expense of all others. This isn't like patriotism. It's about superiority and trying to champion the interests and needs of your country above all else, which is going to lead to increased conflict. So the rise of these nationalist movements, Germany, Italy, developing from the fascist movement, Franco in Spain, you'll also have in Greece and other parts of Europe, Romania, etc., will all turn towards increasingly nationalistic ideas, and this will create increasing opposition and risk of tensions and world war. Okay, so let's look at the first of these. And the first of these crises of the 1930s began with Manchuria. Now, Japan was one of the one of the big four members of the League of Nations and had quite a large status there, but had become increasingly nationalistic and military focused. And although Emperor Hirohito was nominally in charge and worshipped as this emperor, the military was increasingly gaining command, and they resented how they'd been treated after World War One. They joined the side of the Allies. They thought they'd be given territory, and they weren't. And when the economic depression hit, Japan was looking to expand its economy by acquiring territory in the Manchurian region of China, which is sort of north of Beijing, south of Russia, just off the Korean Peninsula. And so they basically ignite a conflict over the Chinese Manchurian Railway. The Chinese government at the time, which is facing problems with its own insurrections, a rising nationalist movement there, and the communist threat coming through, they appeal to the League of Nations. And the trouble here is the League does very little about it. The biggest issue is that with China officially saying, well, hang on, Japan's attacking us, and Japan saying, no, we're not, the League decides to issue an investigation, and it sends ambassadors all the way over to Japan to ascertain the truth of the matter. And this takes a lot of time. This is before jet engines and trains. It takes many months for the delegates to get there. Then they have to investigate. Then they have to come all the way back home. And this, during all this, Japan is securing its hold on the Manchurian territory. So the time and distance become a huge factor here and prevent the League of Nations being able to take effective immediate action. Also, with Japan being one of the big four members of the council, they kind of use their sentence to dominate the council. They use tactics to delay the measures, and they basically ignore the will of the League. The other trouble is a realization that any economic sanctions on Japan are going to fall flat because they trade with America, and without America agreeing to sanctions, which they wouldn't because they're not part of the League of Nations and because of the Great Depression, there's very little of any military might that the League of Nations could bring to bear against Japan. And the bottom line is, it was seen as too far away and not worth the hassle. Japan was acting in China a bit like Britain had acted in India, France had acted in French Indochina, and so on. So they felt that they couldn't really do much, and they lacked the willpower. And for many people, including the contemporary cartoonist David Loeb, who did a lot of cartoons on this, they see this as the moment that the league really ended. And depending on who you speak to, this is also seen as the moment where World War II actually began, because the fighting over Manchuria between Japan and China would go on until the end of World War II, main area of Asian conflict. And so for some people, this is when the league did fail. And after this point, it had proven itself to be ineffective, that it couldn't deal with the situations, and it was dominated by its big members, and its economic sanctions meant nothing. And military sanctions were never going to happen to a militarized nation so far away from European powers. Again, this emphasizes the fact that it is very much a European club. Now, another problem that happened during the 1930s was the failure of the disarmament conference. Now, this obviously, they've been planning a disarmament conference since the end of World War I, and nothing had really happened on this matter. The results of Manchuria and the Japanese militarism towards China precipitated this and led to a disarmament conference being called in the League of Nations in 1932. And the conference met for 2 years, and it came up with a number of proposals. This has included things like not bombing civilian populations, limiting the tonnage of each member state's tanks. And while these were nice ideas and in principle grand statements, they didn't really offer any practical measures about how to make it a reality. So they said, hey, everyone, let's limit it, but they didn't talk about how to go about that or the relative fairness of country size, the issues or problems that might arise from that. And that was a key weakness of the disarmament conference. The other issue that arose was that in 1933, Hitler had gained power in Germany and quite quickly withdrew Germany from the disarmament conference and basically then started rearming. The League wasn't sure what to do about this. And Hitler's argument was quite simply, Germany had been made to disarm after the war. No one else had disarmed. Therefore, Germany was in a vulnerable position. So he was going to start rearming. And the League really wasn't sure what to do about this. They sort of gave moral sanctions, but Britain wasn't that keen to follow through with them. There was a lot of issues about the financial cost, particularly with the League of Nations. Building military, investing in the weapons industry was providing jobs, and people saw Hitler rearming as simply a step towards solving the depression in Germany, potentially a sort of German New Deal, a way to get them out of the depression by providing employment in the army, but in the arms industry, which would increase production in metal industry, glass industry, all those sorts of things going on, and that would boost international trade. They also felt they couldn't really do anything in terms of economic sanctions because that might hit them as well. And most of the countries at this time, because of the rising nationalism that was going on, there was a fear of other countries, a general lack of trust. No one wanted to be the first one to disarm. So although Germany had been made to disarm, France was still wary. They didn't want to disarm unless Britain disarmed. They didn't want to disarm unless Russia had disarmed, which was in the League at this time, or was nearly in the League. They didn't want to disarm unless Italy disarmed. And what about America? Would it disarm? This lack of trust meant that instead of agreeing to the disarmament conference, countries would actually go the other way. Germany, as I said, started rearming and building up their militaries. And there was also a changing attitude to the Treaty of Versailles. So although France, obviously very worried about the potential threat of a German attack and wanted to do something about it, Britain by the 1930s was feeling that the Treaty of Versailles had been too harsh, and the general attitude was more sympathy to Germany. And so they were willing to let Germany and Hitler break the treaty by rearming. Although we'll look at that in a future episode on the steps to war. By 1934, the peace disarmament conference ends in failure, having achieved absolutely nothing. And again, it sends a message to the world that there will be no disarmament, and actually countries are going to start developing their military and weapons. The last time this happened, we ended up with World War One. So it's a huge failure of the League because it means tensions are going to increase between member states as they start to rival each other once again. That's probably going to be best demonstrated, was it 1935, 36? I think 35, where Britain actually signs the Anglo, the Anglo-Nazi naval agreement. It basically says that Germany can start building as many battleships as it likes, as long as it doesn't become more than 35% of the size of the British Navy. A way Britain could say, look, you can rearm, just don't rearm too much to become a threat to us. Kind of abandoned all the principles of the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles. So, after all this, we get to 1936 and the Abyssinia crisis, or 1935 to 36, the Abyssinia crisis. Now, Abyssinia, or modern-day Ethiopia, was one of two countries at this time that were not directly ruled by a European imperial power. The other one was Egypt, although Britain would kind of end up dominating that. The Ethiopians had been attacked back in the 19th century by Italy, and Italy had been kind of humiliated because they'd been defeated by the Ethiopian forces. So we got two issues there. One is that Italy, although it has Libya and that sort of territory in North Africa, it has a relatively small empire compared to Britain and France, and it's seeking economic stability by conquering new territory and a means of enhancing its economic status, but it's also trying to redeem itself from the humiliation it suffered by being the only European power to be defeated outright by an African nation. So Mussolini is targeting Abyssinia. And it's quite obvious what he's planning to do, and he's going to emulate his strategy from Corfu, or he's just going to do it anyway, regardless of what the League says. He uses an excuse, a sort of fake assassination at the Walwal oasis, to sort of trigger all these events. And he starts making a big fuss about it. Now, the League does home into action, and they see a clear case of an aggressor in the form of Mussolini trying to conquer and invade Abyssinia. Although it's in Africa, this is not as far away as Asia. It's worth bearing in mind it was surrounded by British and French imperial territories, places like Somalia and Sudan. So there were European space troops nearby. They could have intervened in this and set things up, but they didn't. And the reason being because they prevaricated on economic sanctions over Abyssinia. They knew America would not support sanctions on Italy, so they would be of limited value anyway. And there was a fear that by cutting off British trade or French trade with Italy, that would damage their own economies. So there was prevarication about what to do. The French were quite keen to get involved. The British were quite keen to get involved, but the French were not, because they saw Italy as a potential counterweight to Germany. They don't want the Germans. So they saw Hitler as their bigger threat, so they wanted Mussolini on side. So they prevaricated, meaning there was a delay to the sanctions being imposed. And even when they did eventually close British and French trade to Italy, it was pretty limited, and was counteracted by the fact that Italy had stockpiled. It had made sure it had plenty of reserves of fuel and other essentials that were likely to be traded so that it could survive a prolonged period of sanctions. So again, another weakness in delaying the imposition. It nullified the effects of them. The other problem was the British and French foreign ministers, Hoare and Laval, basically negotiated a secret pact where they were planning to sort of give Mussolini 2/3 of Abyssinia and allow the emperor of Abyssinia, Haile Selassie, to remain ruling over 1/3. Now, they saw that as a kind of compromise between the two sides to bring peace and stability. When it leaked, it horrified people. Basically, it showed that Mussolini would get what he wanted. It felt like the League, and Britain and France in particular, had betrayed Haile Selassie and the Ethiopians. They were clearly the innocent victim here, but they were going to lose 2/3 of their country to an aggressive Italy because Britain and France were prioritising their own trade ahead of international peace. Mussolini was outraged because he wanted all of Abyssinia and wasn't going to compromise on 2/3. So it was damaging to the reputation of Britain and France, even though it never really came to pass. And it just showed how national self-interest was trumping all the ideas about working together and cooperation. And of course, Italy had its status as a permanent member. Haile Selassie made an emotional plea to the League of Nations. He was met with rapturous round of applause, and in the end, nothing happened. And Mussolini went on to successfully conquer the whole of Abyssinia, and Selassie was basically sent off into exile. If we say Manchuria hadn't caused the death of the League of Nations, Abyssinia almost certainly does. It showed the utter failure of the League. This was a clear case of a wrongdoer on their doorsteps, bullying another country into submission, the very thing the League of Nations was designed to stop. And yet self-interest, economic considerations, and the power of a major European player meant that the League did nothing. And so although Britain and France would still try to make the League work, the League effectively has become irrelevant as a result of Abyssinia. And perhaps worst of all for Britain and France, despite all the hopes that Italy might act as a counterweight to German aggression, after Abyssinia, Mussolini will end up joining in an Axis alliance with Hitler, and will also stand back and allow Hitler to capture or to unify Austria, to have Anschluss with Austria. So it just compounded the weaknesses of the democratic state and at the time the rise and power of the dictators. This will overflow into the Spanish Civil War and on, but really Abyssinia marks the end of the League as, well, I'd say an effective organisation, but it hadn't been effective for very long, but it ends all semblance of the League existing as a worthwhile body, although it will muddle on to World War II. So what conclusions can we draw from all of this? Well, as I said before, the League did work and had some mixed successes during the 1920s. However, it had fatal flaws from its inception. The weakness of the sanctions, the lack of its own military, the reliance on self-interested members, the absence of key players and so on. And all of those were exposed by the financial crisis of the 1930s and the growth of strong-willed nationalistic parties that are not prepared to compromise. Would disarmament have made any difference to this? Probably not, because those states were very unlikely to disarm anyway, but it leads to an arms race, which eventually is going to lead to the war. Was it inevitable? Perhaps. I think it was inevitable the League would fail, but the reason it failed when it did was because of the Great Depression. So the Great Depression was certainly a key moment, but the League was never likely to be the force it had been envisaged to be by Woodrow Wilson or any of the Allies at the start. And that was because too many compromises were made. And to counter that, just for a little follow-on, that's one of the reasons why those issues were sort of largely dealt with or removed during the negotiations about a United Nations. They did learn from the mistakes of the past, but that is another story for the future. Okay, that was a very quick and brief overview of the League of Nations, and hopefully, for those of you studying it, it will be of some use and help make sense of things. Maybe it's confused you more than anything. I hope not, but you never know. This could have happened. But it will also be a useful backdrop for what goes on with the rise of the Nazis and the growth of their militaristic foreign policy and ultimately the steps that will lead to World War II. So useful listening for that. I hope any of this is of interest and use to you. Do feel free to leave a comment or a message if you would like to about anything I could cover in the future. I will be moving on at some point later this week. Although it depends when you listen to this. Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent. I'm going to stop talking now and sign off, but I will be back fairly soon with these first steps to war and the rise of nationalism. Thank you for your time, and I'll see you soon. Oh, and just because someone asked me to do this, and thank you for indulging me by listening to this podcast. Bye.